Sometimes we work hard and fail to work smart. And you know, if you're doing the wrong thing, does it help to do more of it? Does it help to redouble your efforts when you're going the wrong direction? It doesn't. And so Languages of Love, in my opinion, is all about being smarter in the way we love. I had an experience some years ago. I worked at a company where I was a consultant, and they had a lot of big projects. I met a lot of very talented people. One man in particular said to me on a Monday morning, he said, "Wally, I learned a very important family lesson this weekend." And I said, "Tell me about it." He said, "Gladly." He said, "You know, it was our anniversary on Friday evening. So what I did is I arranged for a friend of my wife's, a girlfriend of hers, to take her shopping all day long. And then I took the day off from work, and I spent the day at home cleaning up the house, putting out flowers and candles, and preparing a lovely dinner for us." And he said, "Of course, I felt very, very noble making these sacrifices for my wife." And I said, "How'd it go?" And he said, "Terrible." And I said, "Why is that?" And he said, well, "All day long I worked and I had everything ready. Then her friend, by appointment, brought her home at the specified hour and dropped off his wife. And she came into the house and she saw, you know, the dim light, the candles, the smell of dinner. And she said, 'Wow, thank you, dear.' But it didn't have quite that level of enthusiasm it should have had. Have you husbands ever had that experience? You've done something to try to please your wives, but you knew it wasn't quite the right thing. And so this good man said, 'Honey, what's wrong?' He said, 'Oh, nothing, nothing. I just appreciate so much that you did this for me.' And he said, 'No, what's wrong?' And she said, 'No, it was so sweet of you to do this.' He said, 'Honey, tell me what's bothering you.' So she relented. She said, 'You know, you work long hours. And if you're going to take a day off from work, don't send me shopping. I want to spend the day with you.' Isn't that it was for me a powerful message. Because sometimes we try very hard to do something, but it's the wrong thing. Well, he had assumed that preparing for her a big dinner would be a great blessing. She would rather spend the time with him doing anything because his time was so valuable. So, languages of love. I believe that each of us has a very specific language, a way we prefer to hear the message. Now, intriguingly, just as a side note, it takes a while to learn languages of love. We do it imperfectly throughout our lives. I love the story that Haim Gnat tells. As you can tell, I love the man and his work. Haim Gnat had the experience of training parents. And after a particular session, some parents came up to him and said, "You know, we're trying so hard to use this language of compassion, and it just seems like we can't get it right. We keep trying and keep trying, and we just never get it right." And he, intriguingly, who experienced English as his third language and always spoke with a strong accent, he said, "You know, learning to speak compassion to your children may always be a little bit of a foreign tongue, and you may always express things with an accent. But for your children, it can become their native tongue." Wow. If we try to bring compassion, love, sensitivity, and understanding, we may work at it, we may struggle, we may always do it imperfectly. But if we make our best effort, it can become for our children, for the next generation. It can become, shall we say, second nature. It can become automatic. So I want to talk about four ideas related to languages of love. The first is, watch for opportunities to connect. John Gottman, and incidentally, the best book in the world on marriage is, in my view, this one, called The Seven Principles for Making Marriage Work. It's written by John Gottman, longtime a psychologist at the University of Washington in Seattle. And he has been the researcher who's challenged our ways of thinking about relationships. And in fact, I might say that most marriage programs are still based on the assumption that if I could just share with you in a fair way what's wrong with you, then you could change it and we'd both be happy. So let me ask you, are your favorite conversations those that begin, "I've been thinking about what's weird about you, and I'd like to share it with you in the kindest sort of way"? Does it make you go, "Yes, I've been waiting for this"? Well, probably not. Honest criticism is hard to take from family members, neighbors, friends, strangers. Criticism is not what we seek, is it? Well, so John Gottman has done amazing research. One of the things that he's found, he's written many books. One of them is called Relationship Cure, where he talks about bid busters. And he tells about a couple. He has a laboratory in Seattle where a couple spend time talking and working things through and experiencing a fairly normal weekend. And he tells the story of a couple that was staying in this laboratory, apartment-like place, and the wife, standing at the window overlooking the ocean, said to her husband, "Honey, look at that beautiful sailboat." Men, there's a trick. We're tempted to say, "What's special about that sailboat?" And that's the wrong answer. It's the wrong way to respond. Instead, what she was looking for was not some kind of nautical exchange, not some opportunity to talk about seagoing vessels. Almost any time we say anything to another person, it is a bid for connection. A bid for connection. We're inviting another person to be involved in our lives. In a sense, we're reaching out and saying, "You know what? I'd like you and me to be connected. I'd like us to relate to each other. Would you take note of me and participate in my life in some way?" And very often, not recognizing that that's what it's about, we respond in ways that are bid busters. Let me tell you about bid busters. One is not paying attention. Like, for instance, have you ever been busy about the tasks of the day and a child says, "Hi, Mommy. Hi, Daddy." And we respond how? Nothing. Until they start turning over furniture and start the house on fire, we don't notice. We don't respond. And the child typically is saying, "Hey, I'm home and I'd kind of like you to notice that because I care about you and I hope you care about me." And it's hard for us to shift gears, isn't it? We don't do it easily or automatically. Well, there's another bid buster. Starting on a sour note. A child arrives home and says, "Mom, hi." And we say, "You haven't cleaned your room yet." What do you think? Is this a good response to this bid for connection? Does this leave the child saying, "You love me"? No, it probably is a pretty cold, austere, and unhelpful way of responding to a bid for connection. A third one is using criticism. So a child walks in, and I'm using a parent-child example. A child walks in at the end of the school day and says, "Hi, Mom." And we say, "Can't you tuck in your shirt?" Or let's imagine our spouse comes home and says, "Hi, dear." And we say, "You know, you're late." Well, not a very good way to connect, is it? Pretty natural, but not very helpful. And I hope the substance of what I say is not, "We just don't have a chance." I hope that's not what you take away from what I say. I hope instead what you take away is, if I become more mindful in my family relationships, if I start thinking as a human instead of responding on my automatic reactions, then I can have a lot stronger, healthier relationships. Another bid buster is flooding. Increasingly, psychology has been interested in what we call emotional flooding. The idea that sometimes we overload people with so much emotion that they flood. They're just overwhelmed and cannot respond. And so we talked earlier about the boy who had a bad day on the school bus. and if we overload him with more stuff. If when a child is feeling mildly humble, we give them even more reason for grief, then we flood them, don't we? I wish I could say that I'm wise enough to never do that. It's not true. I remember recently talking to our daughter on the phone, and it's painful for me to admit this. We were talking to our sweet Sarah, who's been dating a young man and wasn't quite sure if they ought to move forward or not, whether they ought to marry or part company. And she had kind of decided maybe they should go different directions. And as she was talking about that, she said, "Dad, it's so hard. What can I do with the love I have for him?" Boy, I hate to admit that what I said was, "You know, dear, if you'd heeded your concern earlier, you wouldn't have that pain today." Oh, man. Why not, when someone's in pain, hook them up to the car and drag them for a while in the street? I mean, she didn't need me to say that. I was adding insult to injury, rubbing salt in the wound. What she needed me to do is say, "Oh, Sarah, isn't that hard? When you've got all this love for another person, you're not sure what to do with it." Well, that's one form of bid busting. There's another one. Practicing a crabby habit of mind. Anyone here ever crabby? Show of hands. We got a few honest people. Yeah. Anyone here seeking to be crabby most of the time? It has taken a while, but the family has finally discovered that they ought not to ask any questions or make any special requests of me after I have paid the bills. I am just an ornery, cantankerous kind of person. And sometimes if a family member approaches me at a time like that, I say, "You know, that's not a very good question right now. And in fact, if you don't mind, I'm going to send me to my room." Sometimes we sense that we're not in very good spirits, and we end up taking it out on family members. Isn't it better if, recognizing our poor state of mind, instead of lashing out at family members who may have hoped to catch us in good humor, isn't it better if we say, "I'm sorry, I don't have my best to offer you right now. Let me see if I can settle myself down and be a better family member for you later." So that's another bid buster, is practicing a crabby habit of mind. Another is avoiding the conversation you need to have. Avoiding the conversation. It keeps a cold distance between people, doesn't it? So, for instance, after saying to Sarah something that wasn't very helpful, I can call her or email her and say, "Sarah, I'm sorry that I wasn't more helpful, because I love your tender soul. I love your sweetness and goodness. I love the way you care about others." That's the conversation that needs to be had. To fail to do that is to fail to respond to the bid. Well, isn't it funny how sometimes we're very synchronized with certain people? So, for instance, Andy and I seem to have always been very much in tune. So, for instance, we could be sitting in an evening, just sitting around doing things, whatever, and we might look up and happen to catch each other's eyes. And one of us would nod. And we would jump up, grab the car keys, and go to the local store and buy chips and salsa. We just knew. We just knew. Because Andy and I very much had a common language. Now, that's not always the case, is it? Sometimes we have children who, the harder they try to please us, the more we resent them. And it is for those children that we must be wise, we must be patient. In my view, we should pray for help. Because if we're left to our automatic ways, we may develop a relationship that gets worse and worse and worse. So watch for opportunities to connect. Another example, once I came home from work and was feeling a lot of pressure because I had meetings in the evening. And as I was dashing from place to place, our son Andy, then probably 7 or 8 years old, caught me and he said, "Dad, today at school my leg really hurt me. I just ached and I don't know what's wrong." And it was real clear to me that he was concerned that there could be something very seriously amiss, something physiological. And he was worried about it. And it's easy to respond with our needs in mind instead of theirs. I was tempted to say, "Andy, do I look like the on-call physician? I mean, what do you want me to do about it?" I didn't do that. Instead, I had on that occasion just enough good sense to say, "Andy, I have to go to a meeting. I expect to be back about 8:30. Would it be okay if, when I get back, I pick you up and we go to the local neighborhood restaurant and have dessert together, and you and I can talk and see if we can figure this out?" Well, Andy was all over that. He said, "Sure, Dad, that'd be great." So I went to my meeting and got home at the appointed time. And I said, "Are you ready, buddy?" He said, yeah, I'm ready." So we took off and went to, I don't know that you have them here, JB's Big Boy was the name of the restaurant. And we settled in and ordered our desserts. We'd only had, say, 3,000 calories that day, so we figured we needed another 1,000. So we both ordered desserts. And there at that restaurant, they had paper placemats. So we played tic-tac-toe, and we talked and laughed, and he told me about his day. And I kind of let him take the lead. I figured that he would bring up the leg when he was ready. It never came up. And I don't mean to suggest by that he didn't have an authentic leg ache during the day. What I would suggest is many of our aches and pains are an expression of our heart, not our legs. They're saying, "My life is sometimes kind of confusing and overwhelming, and I just wonder if anybody out there cares about that and would take time for me." If Andy had brought up the leg, we would have talked about it and asked when it hurt and how much and where, and tried to figure something out and decide if he needed to go to the physician. He didn't. The healing time he needed was not a slice of pie, a slice of Dad. So languages of love. Watching for opportunities to connect. And I guess speaking now as a grandparent, I'd say that Nancy and I are always looking for opportunities to connect with our grandsons. Because we have finally gotten just wise enough to say, anytime we get a chance, we'll take it. So when Max says, "Papa, come and look at my train," do I say, "You know, Max, I'm quite busy and actually fairly important. I don't really have time for trains." No, the universe stops and Max and I go look at his train. In fact, in our house in Little Rock, we live 500 miles from our grandson, Shad, and about 1,500 miles from Max and Sam. When they come to visit, we want to make the time special. So I went up in our attic, put down some flooring in what was otherwise just an open attic, and then I set up a suspended track at just their height so I could set up my childhood electric train. And we go up there in the attic, and the boys run around the attic following the train. I guess I shouldn't tell you this, but last time, I won't even tell his name, one of our grandsons was there. He got so excited that he just ended up standing in a puddle of water. It's probably better I not tell you which one it was. Let me move to a second idea. If we want to be effective at languages of love, we should notice what our partner or child loves. Notice what they love. Notice what they ask for. Notice what they care about. Notice what has worked in the past. Perhaps the single most important lesson I've learned about languages of love came from our own experience. Nancy and I have been married now for almost 33 years. And we say 33 years of uninterrupted wedded bliss, and then we pause. And anyone who laughs has some marriage experience. Those who look very earnestly think, "Oh, isn't that wonderful?" I think, "You need to get married." Well, so after 27 years of marriage, I realized that my usual way of showing love to Nancy wasn't working very well. See, I'm a person who loves stuff in virtually all forms. I love stuff. I mean, I love toys. I love books. I just love stuff. And so I don't feel too alone, let me just ask, is there anyone here in a similar state? Anyone here love stuff? See, and I have to keep creating new storage space to store all that stuff I simply cannot live without but have no place to use. And Nancy's kind of weird because she says, whenever I think about buying something, she says, "How will you use it, honey?" And I say, "Honey, that's a goofy question. I'll store it, but I'll know that I have it. And I'll be happy because I have it." So I love stuff. I mean, if you want to catch me afterwards, in my bag that I carry, I've got about a dozen finger puppets. Because, you know, finger puppets are stuff and they make life good. And I've got a whole bunch of publicity pieces, and I'm glad you asked what those are. When our first grandson was born, Max, Andy was concerned. You don't want a baby making calls and not having a business card. So he created a business card for him. When Max turned one, Andy created an annual report. In the center are the profits and losses. On the back is the letter to shareholders. You know, you don't want a kid to have to present himself to the world without an annual report. When he turned two, he was talking, but nobody knew what he was saying. So Andy created the Maxwell decoder card so he could translate what he said. When Max was three, Max is a brilliant little learner. He's a small boy, about the 10th percentile for height and weight, which has made us worry at times, but he is an avid learner. That boy he eats knowledge like it was tacos. Well, when he turned three, Andy issued the card, the Maxwell Institute for Learning and Growth. We as a family are the faculty. Max there is there in his headmaster's outfit with his little brother, 8-month-old Sam, with a full beard. Well, and I'm sure that this will get me in trouble, but one of our recent pieces is this one, Max for President. So if you come to the U.S., I can tell you, that's a good leader, that Max. Well, so, okay, I love stuff. I just love stuff. So when I feel loving and appreciative towards Nancy, what do? I buy her stuff, of course. Anyone in their right mind loves stuff. Some of you know probably what the conspiracy of nature is. It's a term we use in physics, and it ties to some things like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And anyway, the conspiracy of nature, it operates in marriage as well. No matter who you marry, it is a person who does not want to be loved the way you like to show love. The same is broadly true of each of your children, too. Each child prefers to be loved in a way that's different from the way you like to love them. That would seem like an ironic and painful and unfair twist on fate, but think of it as a blessing.